This is a talk from bethinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defense of the Christian gospel. So visit bethinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a bethinker to hear all about bethinking.org's latest releases. I feel like
Why don't we make a bit of a start? Because I reckon the people that really matter are here. So let's just kick it off. Feels very formal standing behind this, but so I'm going to give a seminar on the moving graphic image, and I'm going to do that, as I was telling Ali, with absolutely no visuals whatsoever. It's terrible. No film clips, not even an OHP presentation. It really does reflect how unqualified I am to deal with the subject, but let's make a go of it anyway. Now, the focus of this seminar is to connect the use of film to apologetics. And I want to begin by putting the use of film in what I'm calling the apologetic spectrum. Apologetics can be defined in various ways. I define it like this. It's the commending of the gospel to those who are outside the Christian faith. The commending of the gospel to those who are outside of the Christian faith. And in the interest of clarity, I divide the apologetic process into three stages. And of course, it's never as neat as this in practice, but I see three basic stages in the apologetic process. The third and final stage I call proclamation, and proclamation is all about the telling of the core gospel, that Christ has come in the flesh, he's died, he's risen, he's ascended into heaven, and that salvation is found in him, the core gospel, the thing that brings people across the line. This is proclamation, the most precious part for me of the apologetic process. My complaint today is that still for so many, this is the only stage in the apologetic process. This is all we do. And I think because of that, we miss many, many opportunities for the gospel. And that's where I back up now to the second stage in the apologetic spectrum, which I call persuasion. And in this stage, you're dealing with someone who is open to an alternative worldview. They're not yet inside. They're probably skeptical, but they're open to a discussion, to a dialogue. And in the persuasion stage, you're giving reasons why Christianity is not only a credible faith, it's the credible faith. And so you're giving your reasons, you're giving your explanations, you're persuading them to the Christian faith. And I think today, most often, persuasion needs to come before proclamation. And I think there's several seminars dealing with this stage. The first stage in the apologetic spectrum I call subversion. Subversion. And this is what we need to do when we're dealing with someone who is totally closed to Christianity. They have absolutely no perceived need of Christianity or interest in it. They're completely closed. And of course, this is the group which is the greatest challenge to us as evangelists, as apologists. And I think it goes without saying that the majority on our university campuses fall within this camp. They need subversion in order to move them to persuasion, where you can enter a dialogue, and then God helping us move into proclamation. Now, this first stage is absolutely critical, and I think the one that we need to give more attention to. And for me, subversive apologetics is all about getting inside the other person's worldview and rattling their cage. Get inside their worldview and rattle their cage. And what I want to do in this seminar is to look at how film can function as a subversive apologetic, how it fits into this first stage. I haven't measured this, computed it mathematically, but I guess that in my meaningful conversations with non-Christians, and non-Christians who are closed, 80% of meaningful conversations are through the doorway which is provided by film. At least 80%. It is just such a natural point of connection. Which is why I think it's important that we grapple with how we can use it in this first stage. Now, I have four main headings here in this talk. And under each of these main headings, there's a number of subheadings. This is going to be like a good English Puritan sermon, my 39th point, sub. 16 is, no, it's not going to be quite like that. It's going to be a little bit wooden in that sense. But I want to grind my way through quite a bit of material before we open it up to discussion. My first main heading is this. We mustn't underestimate the power of film. We mustn't underestimate the power of film. Stating it another way, I think it would be hard to overestimate the impact of film upon our culture. And that's why we as Christians, as those who are involved in mission and apologetics, have to capitalize on the advantages that film affords us. To pass it by for me is disastrous. It is so valuable, so influential, so powerful that we need to capitalize on it while also recognizing the dangers inherent in film and dealing with film. And I'm not going to deal with those dangers this afternoon. I want to look at how we capitalize on the advantages. And my first subheading under this main point is that I want to briefly reflect on the power of film as an art form. Film is art. And I think we just need to name it for what it is, and that means we need to engage with it as art and respect it as art. Now, the two key things about our relationship to art is that, firstly, we as human beings shape art. It's the extension, the overflow of our creativity. The other side of art is that art shapes us. We shape it, it shapes us. And in the sense that art shapes us, we need to appreciate the enormous power that something like film has on human imagination, rationality, will, and so forth. Art is one of the deepest cultural influences on any people group. And that's why if you really want to get to grips with the culture, whether it be in the past or in the present, you have to engage with its art forms, and especially its dominant representations. It's interesting, when Paul is stuck in Athens waiting for Timothy, Acts 17, he wants to get to grips with the city, and what does he do? He deals with its dominant representations. He goes to the temples and he looks at the idols. This is how he begins his engagement. And although the parallels don't work exactly, I would say going to the cinema today is a way of getting to grips with our culture, dealing with these dominant representations, dominant symbols. Now, the power of this art form, it may, for me, be the most powerful art form ever created, ever generated by human beings. The power of it lies in the manner in which it combines various media. And for me, the foundation of film is the graphic image. Daniel Boorstin, the American historian, talks about the graphics revolution, the turn of the 20th century. Massive changes flowing out of this revolution, culminating, I believe, apex of this revolution in the film, the moving graphic image. The power of the graphic image is that it's an exact simulation of reality. It captures it exactly as it is, and it looks so real, and our experience of the simulation is so real, and yet it's only a representation. It's extraordinary. We have so many of them in our lives, but it really is an extraordinary thing. And then when you put them together and you make them move, as it does in film, it means that we can actually create whole new worlds. Film has the power to reconfigure our experience of space. Star Wars. Complete new experience of space. Parallels reference points to how we experience, but it's reconfigured. Film also has the power to reconfigure our experience of time. The two most basic relationships human beings have to reality is space and time. Film can reconfigure both of these. It has that kind of power. And it does it so in a way that no other art form can. So the graphic image, the moving graphic image, combined with this is the employment of the dramatic arts. And because millions and billions or millions are put into the blockbuster hits, you have acting of the highest quality put together with the graphic image. There are some exceptions, but these people have made it to where they are because they're good. I know a little bit about acting. These guys know what they're doing. And then underneath this, you put a strong musical score, and it adds even more power to it. And I think in film, we have perhaps the greatest artistic medium ever. Those of you who know anything about Wagner, I think Wagner would say, my dream has come true in this. He wanted to bring different artistic mediums together in his operatic performances. This brings so much together, creates something which is so powerful, creates whole new worlds, which is what Wagner wanted to do. Now, all this happens at the cost of millions and billions, and it can be transferred into our living rooms for almost nothing. We live in an extraordinary world. Before, it was the rich who could hang a Rembrandt on their wall, and the rest of us make do with cheap reproductions. But now, these artistic creations cost of millions and boom, zap, straight into our living room. So it really is such a powerful medium bringing all these different things together. Second point here under the power of film, I want to reflect on the power of film as a universal language. Up until cinematography, art tended to divide people. Often this divide was along socioeconomic lines. High culture belonged to the rich, folk culture more to the poor, and not a whole lot of overlap there. Language, different language, European languages would create a divide in terms of arts. Different religions would create divides. Different cultural, the cultural differences would also bring divides. Film crosses all these divides. Film is one of the few things that almost everyone engages with. Certainly the blockbuster films. We had a discussion at lunch. And the soap operas are okay, but there's a number of soap operas to choose from, and very few people watch all of them. Whereas film, 95%, I'm guessing, of people you talk to have watched the blockbuster. So it's universal in that sense. They're ubiquitous in terms of their influence. And these films create common symbols, common heroes, common villains, which we all relate to. It even creates a common language. There's a little 2-year-old on the Labrie property where I work, and he keeps running around calling about Barf Vader. He's never even seen the thing before, but he just wants to be Barf Vader. Arr, he says every time he sees me. He's 2 years old. Barf Vader. I actually think film is a huge factor in globalization. Many things have forwarded the rise of globalization. Film is amongst, I think, one of the highest things, the top things in making us live in a global world which is very much connected together. Now, this universality provides a point of commonality in our apologetic work. It means that there's a genuine point of engagement with almost everyone we have contact with. And in a world which is increasingly tribal, or increasingly global on the one hand, but increasingly tribal on the other, this is a huge advantage, because film transcends all our tribal differences. About 12 years ago, I thought that I would focus on music as a way of connecting with people today, but I soon realized it was a huge mistake, because I began to look into dance music, but this person listens to this type of dance music, this person listens to that. I couldn't tell the difference, but they'd beat each other to death on a Friday night. I thought, this is too tribal. And I went to film, it's because it's something which actually is so universal, transcends all these differences, and that's why we have to capitalize on it. My third sub-point here is this. I want to reflect on the power of film to span the public and private spheres of life. It's really connected to my previous point. The power of film to span the public and private spheres of life. The modern person has two personas. Our private persona, what we are in our homes, our private world, and our public personas. And for the vast majority, there's not a lot of overlap between these two personas. We're one thing in the home, another thing in the public square. And that's why it's so often difficult to get past weather and football when we're dealing with people in the public arena. Because what we are in the private sphere is locked away there. We become someone else in the public sphere. Now, the thing about film is that it belongs to both worlds. And if you look at the history of cinema, it belonged in its inception very much to the public square. Do you guys know the Italian film Cinema Paradiso? It's a gorgeous film. And it's really about the demise of cinema from the public square. And it was a huge loss. This was a gathering of people. This is where the community happened. You went and watched the news there and so forth. It was very much the center of town life. Now, today it's still public in the sense that it's a public industry. And we still have cinemas that draw us out. And certainly when you look at the stars, they're public faces. They're absolutely everywhere. So film is still very public on the one hand, and yet it's so private on the other. We order our DVD from... We did get ours from Tesco now through the post. Bam, bam, bam. They keep coming through the post. And in the privacy of our home, we bang it on the machine. And behind the closed door, we watch the film. A couple of years ago, 4 pubs a week in England were closing down. And many social commentators say probably due to the DVD. Just so much to watch. Beer so much cheaper to buy at the supermarket, but it's part of the withdrawing into the private. My point here is, though, is that film belongs to both worlds. It's a very public thing. It's a very private thing. And so it's one of the few things which brings both of these worlds together in a meaningful way. And that's a huge advantage for evangelism. People are often happy to bring their experience of film, an experience they had in the private place, to bring that into the public square. They'll talk about it there. And it's something which unites us in the public square, where our evangelism needs to happen, so much of it. And that's why it's a valuable tool for apologetics. So that's my first point. Don't underestimate the power of film. My second main heading is this. This really is a Puritan sermon. It's dreadful. My second main heading, allow film to function as narrative. Allow film to function as narrative. And this is perhaps the thing I'm going to stress most loudly this afternoon. If we ask the question, what is film? Depending what angle you come at the question, you're going to come up with different answers. If you think about what is film in terms of the medium, you say it's moving representations. If you ask what is film in terms of content, it's simply a story. Films are about stories. That's primarily what they are. Films are narratives. Now, my first subheading here. A great film is always connected to a great story. Simple, it's an axiom. A great film is always connected to a great story. It's actually a very simple way of evaluating the quality of a film. Is it a good story? And I think the last 10 years has shown us, 5 years at least, that special effects alone cannot make a great film. I almost walked out of Pearl Harbor. Dreadful, in my opinion. The story was so weak. Massive on the special effects front. But the story, so weak. And the incongruity between those things just overwhelmed me. So a great film needs a jolly good story. Now, it's a great comfort to me in our times that human beings have an insatiable appetite for a great story. For us as Christians and apologists, that's very important to hang on to. All human beings have an insatiable appetite for a great story. And sometimes I've worried whether or not pop culture today is going to kill that off. I don't believe it anymore. And you see it. When the epic story is put into film, the cinemas fill up, don't they? Look what happened to Tolkien. Just blew us away. This epic story. Star Wars. In my books, an epic story. Epic means big. When I use the word epic, I'm talking about a cosmic story, a story as big as the universe, a story that has this kind of dance between the natural and the supernatural, a story full of superheroes, a story which reflects a cosmic struggle between good and evil. That's an epic story. And I actually think Narnia just about qualifies as an epic story. And look what happens. It's breaking records. So many people want to see it. Who don't have a clue about the Lewis books, but they're drawn to the story. These kind of stories we can't resist. Oh, an exception to this, by the way, was Troy. Talk about epic story, Homer. Utterly destroyed by that film. I've just read the two books this year, Iliad and Odyssey. And you take the supernatural out of Troy, you've got the destruction of an epic. Dreadful. My daughter kills me for saying it, but anyway, that was my opinion. So we love epic stories. We also love the more down-to-earth stories, which connect with the basic longings of our human existence. Stories about relationships, about family, about home. Let me tell you one of my top movies. This is in my top five. It's an Australian film called The Castle. Anybody seen it? Gorgeous, isn't it? This simple story about home. About a home, about a family's castle, very simple Australian family. You laugh and laugh, but then suddenly you find yourself crying. So moving to see the love between them. We love those kind of stories too. So a little statement to take away with you. The apologetic advantage is in the story. I'm going to keep repeating that. The apologetic advantage is in the story. I want to keep developing that point. My second subheading. We need to engage with film as narrative. Second subheading, don't allow your engagement with film to be fed only through the moral or truth grid. Don't allow your engagement with film to be fed only through the moral or the truth grid. I think many, many Christians tend to view everything through either a truth consciousness or a moral consciousness. They have either an overactive rationality or an overactive conscience, both of which are so important, but they're overactive, and they're engaged in the neglect of other operations of our inner lives. So someone who has an overactive moral consciousness, they're watching a film and they're witnessing someone behaving badly. Say, or we say, oh, that person shouldn't be having sex. And we actually lose the story in the moral judgment. I think this happens with many, many Christians. Now, that's not to say we justify this kind of behavior out there, but it's not about a moral judgment. I remember showing a group of people the film years ago, Life is Beautiful. And there were all these moral statements about how could they do this with the background of concentration camps and Nazi atrocities. And you think, oh, you lost the story. It doesn't call for moral judgments about that. That's just the backdrop to the story. Focus on the story. We can have an overactive moral consciousness, which means we lose the story. It's why my youth group leader kept showing us Chariots of Fire week after week after week. It was the only film that was morally credible to be shown in his view. Back then I wanted to say to him, have you ever read Judges 19 to 21? Do you know those chapters? I mean, they make Tarantino look like a choir boy. In the Bible, part of the story of the children of Israel. A hideous part, but it's part of the story. Those who have an overactive truth consciousness, they're watching a film and someone says as part of the dialogue, God is dead. And they start arguing for the existence of God. This person doesn't believe in God. And they lose the story. Now, I'm not saying that stories rise above a moral critique or a truth critique. They don't rise above them. But my point is that too easily the story is obscured by the moral and the truth grid. And because Christians tend to view reality through those grids, often we're not very good at watching film. We don't allow it to function as art. Now, the power of the story is in the appeal to the imagination. There's rationality, there's conscience and will, there's imagination. And it's actually through the imagination that we make deep connections to reality. The power of imagination is that it can move us beyond abstractions. If we have an overactive rationality or an overactive morality, we're always dealing with abstractions. And the thing about an abstraction is that it's much thinner than reality. It's not the real. It's a statement about the real or a model that reflects the real. But imagination helps connect us to the real world, to life. And I believe so much of modern life today is abstract. So much of church life can be abstract. It's disconnected from the real. And people today are hungry for reality. And the power of story is that it can connect them to reality. People love story because this is what it does. And that's why we have to allow film to function as narrative. The apologetic advantage is in the story. Developing this a little bit more, my third subheading here is this: learn to make connections between the film narrative and our own stories. Learn to make connections between the film narrative and our own stories. I said the power of story is that it connects us to reality. It connects us to life. And stories do this because they offer us the possibility of identification. There's Frodo, not my favorite scene in the Tolkien trilogy, but there's Frodo near the end of the third one saying this very, very long goodbye to Sam, Pippin, and Merry. Too long, in my opinion. But at the same time, I had a deep identification with what's going on there. Because born in Canada, living in England, I've gone many times through that painful process of goodbyes to people who are very precious to me while I sailed off into the West. I guess it was East, really, wasn't it? But the point is that watching that clip of film helped me identify with something in my own story. And in this sense, stories offer the possibility for participation. We share in the story. By sharing in this story, we actually are able to share in our own story. And that's very powerful. It's very powerful because it can shed deeper light on our own human experience. It can help us evaluate what we've gone through, what we're going through, give us new insights into the nature of reality, the reality of our story. And this is so, so powerful. And it's why Jesus used so many stories. Now, my favorite is in Luke chapter 10, verse 25. This is when the bright young lawyer comes to test Jesus. He's in the third group, totally closed, has no need whatsoever of what Jesus is offering. So Jesus becomes a subversive apologist. And Jesus is faced with a question by this bright young lawyer. It's a theological question: who is my neighbor? Now, being the type of person I am, my tendency would have been to jump in for a debate, a philosophical, theological debate. Just boom, take this lawyer on. But Jesus is much, much wiser than I would have been. And what does he do? He tells a story. That's how he answers the question. He tells a story. He's being the subversive apologist. And the story he tells this young lawyer has the familiar in it. It's connected to a world that he knows. This man probably would have walked that road from Jerusalem to Jericho. So Jesus told a story out of the lawyer's world. Jesus steps into this world so this guy can identify with the story Jesus is telling. And actually, when you examine this story closely, we don't have the time to do that now, but you see that not only does Jesus create a point of identification through the story, he also connects with this guy's worldview. He's in this guy's world through the story. He's in this guy's worldview. That's subversive apologetics. You've got to get inside the other's worldview and story in order to do your work. It's exactly what Jesus is doing with the bright young lawyer. And this is where the subversive element comes in. When you get inside another person's story, you also climb inside their worldview. If you just go straight for the worldview, for the person who's closed, you'll just alienate them. But if you actually get inside a story, you're in the remit of their worldview too. There's a connection to that. So that's the point of engagement. It's from the inside. And in this sense, we're not dealing with polemics here. There is a place for polemical apologetics. When we defend our belief system from our corner, on our turf, there's a place for that. But what I'm talking about here is very different. It's stepping into the other person's story and working from within it. Now, I believe that film as narrative allows us to do that, because we're all sharing these stories. We live our stories often through these stories as they elucidate our own experience. And as we go into those stories, we make a deep connection with the person we're dealing with, the person who's closed. My fourth subheading here, just developing my argument a bit more, is this. Learn to make connections between the film narrative and the meta-narrative. Learn to make a connection between the film narrative and the meta-narrative. First of all, it's between the film narrative and the personal story. Our story, the other's story, other person's story. But then it's between the film narrative and the meta-narrative. Now, the meta-narrative is at the very heart of our Christian faith. And it's the one true epic story. The story of what God has done through history. It's really His story. He made it. He's redeeming it. It's His story. And it's epic. It's huge. I love 1 Timothy 3:16. I've spoken this recently at a guest Christmas service because I wanted to develop the Christmas story as an epic story. And 1 Timothy 3:16, for me, reads like the storyboard of a film. My oldest son is making films now, and the storyboard is so important. The broad outline, this is where it's going to go. Paul says, he appeared in a body, was justified by the Spirit, was seen by angels, was preached among the nations, was believed on in the world, was taken up in glory. The words themselves, not that exciting, but as a storyboard, there's so much here. This is epic. This is huge. This is cosmic. It's the chapter outline for a film. Now, this is talking about Christ's work, what Christ has done. He appeared, he was incarnate, his death, resurrection, ascension, glorification, and so forth. Now, these aren't theological abstractions. They're part of a story. Now, what Paul is talking about here actually fits into an even bigger story. There's a meta-outline that this fits into. And it's a thing you guys will know so well. It's creation, fall, and redemption. Creation, fall, and redemption. We have to get this inside our minds. It's such so powerful as story. And it is story. This is not ultimately theology. Creation, fall, redemption. It's our story. God made it. It got ruined. God's putting it right. That's the story of history. If I can put it like this, this is the difference between systematic theology and biblical theology. Biblical theology is about the story. It's about the narrative, how the narrative develops through the Bible. Whereas systematic theology is taking out different abstractions to make sense of it. Both absolutely necessary. Now, my point in terms of our story is that we're dealing here with biblical theology. Biblical theology in its meta-outline, creation, fall, redemption. Now, the point I want to make here is that every other story which has ever been told is set within this meta-narrative. And every story ever told connects in some way to the meta-narrative. Every single one, it reflects the meta-narrative in some way. So every story that has evil in it is connected to the meta-narrative. It's a fallen world. Every story about love, about war, about sacrifice, about poverty, about scandal, the list goes on and on. These are all representations of our meta-narrative, the one true story that we live within as Christians. That, for me, is so important to grasp. Every story connects to the meta-narrative in some way. Now, when we use film narrative as an apologetic, we need to seize on these connections to the meta-narrative. When we step inside the story of the film narrative, we make affirmations from within about our own story, about our meta-narrative. Now tonight, those of you who are brave enough to come along at late hour to watch Whale Rider, not to give the whole thing away, this is a neo-pagan film. I'm not reading into it, it's just so obvious. This is about neo-paganism. The Renaissance, the restoration of a pagan way of living to a modern Mare people. And yet, the outlines of this story connect so deeply to our story, the one true meta-narrative. It's about the exile of a people, the Mare people. How they're being assimilated into the world around them. Well, that has an interesting parallels with our story. Happened to the Jews over and over. Called to be holy, the pressure to assimilation, the loss of identity. The film Whale Rider is all about people waiting for salvation. This theme of waiting for someone to come to save them. Then it's about the appearance of a surprise Messiah. Someone who has the signs of being called, and yet people don't want to recognize this individual. And then finally, it's about redemption through death and resurrection. I'm not reading into it. It's just so obviously there. It's neo-pagan in terms of its worldview, and yet the outlines reflect so much of the true meta-narrative, which is true of all stories. There's always points of connections. Totally pagan, and yet the outline of the story has many, many parallels with Christianity, Christian story. Now, subversive apologetics through film seizes on the similarities. It exploits them. And it affirms our story from within the other story, while recognizing the essential differences of worldview. But it's not primarily about arguing worldview within films. It's about story. The apologetic advantage is in the story. So within that story where you see a parallel, a reflection of our story, you affirm it. That's what you're doing. Appealing to imagination. The film has been around for a while now. I love it. Shawshank Redemption. From a novel by Stephen King. The outlines of Shawshank Redemption is our meta-narrative. It starts with original perfection, the beautiful wife, the successful lawyer. There's a massive fall. There's a catastrophe. And it's world in utter chaos. And it ends with redemption, where actually the end is even better than the beginning. Now, I don't know the worldview of that film. I suspect it's actually more Buddhist. Stephen King's a really strange person. I suspect this one has a more Buddhist feel than it does Christian. But in terms of meta-narrative, or the story and how it connects to our meta-narrative, there's so many things to affirm there. That's how we need to use them. So my point is that the primary focus of apologetics through film is not to highlight the differences between our faith and someone else's, but it's actually focusing on the similarities of the story. That's the subversive part. Now, very briefly here to say that some films, something to be very grateful for, work self-consciously within the meta-narrative. Tim LaHaye's Left Behind. No, I'm just joking. Definitely not those ones. Sorry, couldn't watch them, actually. But there are a number of films out there who are put together by people who are very self-consciously within the Christian worldview, working within the Christian meta-narrative. One of my favorite films, it's more of an artsy film, but it's the film Heaven by Kieslowski. It's extraordinary. This is a film about the love of Christ overcoming sin. It's what the film's about. It's just so blatantly within our story, because it's put together by a Catholic who's very clearly within the Christian worldview. Another favorite of mine within the Christian meta-narrative is Michael Douglas stars in it. It's The Game. That is unbelievable. And look it up in the internet. The guys who put that together, very, very serious in their intent to actually reflect the gospel in it. It's about repentance. It's about death, resurrection, hearing the call of God, being called by God to new life. Incredible. I forget the Christian CRS, and these guys who wrote it, I should tell you what it stands for. Christian Restoration something. And then we've just talked at the beginning about the film Magnolia. Incredible. The Catholic who put it together very self-consciously, working within the Christian meta-narrative, Christian worldview, a film about judgment, about grace, about forgiveness. It's so moving. So we have these we can work with also. My third main heading, and I'm going to whip through this, is this. Be attentive to the worldview which lies beneath every film. Be attentive to the worldview which lies beneath every film. Another axiom, well, it's not really an axiom, it's a statement I feel strongly about. There is no such thing as a mindless film. It's dangerous to see films as mindless. We have films which are either good or bad, but they're not either mindful or mindless. Every film is based on some kind of idea of the universe. There's a worldview beneath every film. Now, my first subheading here is allow the worldview to enrich the story. When we get to grips with the underlying worldview of a film, it actually enhances our imaginative engagement. It gives the film greater depth and therefore greater enjoyment. I have to say that the more my Christian worldview has developed, the more I've developed my Christian mind, the more I've come to love film. It just makes them so much deeper and richer. You need to teach your students how to watch films with a Christian mind in this sense. But a little warning here, don't let the worldview approach turn films into a philosophical discourse. The guy who mentored me in watching film, he was brilliant in film, but he tended in this direction. Every film was in the end a philosophical statement, usually the transition from modernism to postmodernism. And often the story was obscured. It could be a little bit artificial. The purpose of clarifying a worldview within a film is to help us see where the story is coming from. It provides handles for discussing the story with an unbeliever. Now, my second subheading here, this is Puritan now. I'm going to whistle through 9 worldview questions which provide handles on the story, the film narrative. When we come to a film, here's 9 worldview questions that I think is helpful to have in mind. We can call them apologetic checkpoints. Firstly, what does the story reflect about what it means to be human? And for me, most importantly, is there a strong sense of the dignity of humanity, the glory of humanity? I tell you, a film I was dreading watching was Napoleon Dynamite. My kids loved it, and I thought, geek, they're just going to trash this guy. And I'm very sensitive to the trashing of human beings in films. I loved it, because at the end, it didn't totally trash him. This guy was left intact with his dignity. Yet at the same time, we ask, is it honest about the depravity of human beings? That human beings are twisted out of shape by something. I think today most films are very honest about that. I don't see many just glorifying humanity. Usually it's how dark we are. They said the most offensive films to me are the ones which obscure the dignity of human beings. 20th century film knows how evil we are. 100 years of surrounded by it. A little aside here, my number one film on my top 10 is Blade Runner. Greatest film for me ever made. Because it's exploring what it means to be human in the most profound way. Unbelievable film. Second question, what kind of universe exists? Is it a naturalist universe? Is it Legoland? One-dimensional, horizontal, impersonal, just Lego bricks, nothing behind it, nothing around it. Is it a naturalist universe or is it a supernaturalist universe? Matrix, the obvious example. More than the natural. Now, I'm interested today in the fact that more and more films are reflecting a supernaturalist universe. For me, almost seems more common than the naturalist universe. Over and over. Often in a very subtle way. We can miss it if we're not looking carefully. But it leaves us with a question mark. Maybe there's more to reality than just the scientific, the materialist. Now, this is very valuable in terms of engagement. When we do watch a good naturalist film, often we'll see that it reflects honestly about how empty such a universe is. If this is all there is, that we're doomed. I think the Truman Show does this brilliantly at the end, walking through the black door into nothing. Into nothing. And there's some great films which are from a naturalist perspective and say, oh, how can we live in such a universe? That's very helpful. Important worldview issue right there. Third question, how does the story reflect history? Is history fatalistic? Is it like a Greek tragedy where it is moved to our end and there's nothing we can do to escape it? In a sense, this is the story of Troy, Homer's Troy. Or do our own choices actually determine the outcome? Schindler's List. I think it's a huge issue in cinematography today. How much real choice do we have to direct our affairs and the affairs of the human race? Some do both of these. I love Kieslowski's Three Colors trilogy, and Red, for me, is beautiful in terms of how it reflects the power of choice and the power of God, the supernatural behind, bringing things to their appointed end. The Game is doing exactly the same. These two things explore together in a very profound way. Fourth question, how is evil portrayed in the story? Is evil banalized? Are we simply entertained by evil in this film? Kill Bill. The film has strengths in other places, but for me it's the banalization of evil. Contrast to that would be Scorsese's Taxi Driver. Very dark film, but it takes evil seriously. It shows the dark side. It shows us how serious sin is. We live in a world where sin is too easily trivialized, romanticized. A film like this is a healthy reality check. And I think many film narratives do this today. It shows us how evil is. Fifth question, does existence have meaning? Is there meaning in our universe? And is this meaning bestowed upon us, or do we just have to create it? The other week I watched Collateral. I found that a very interesting film. Two characters there. The character played by Cruz, who's nameless, no name, no meaning. And for him, the universe is empty of meaning. There is no meaning. On the other side, you've got the taxi driver, Max. Cool Max. And he actually escapes the meaninglessness of his existence by stepping out of the comfort zone. It's so much about meaning between two people facing very different directions. Sixth question, how does the story deal with the issue of justice? This is a massive theme in cinematography today. All these revenge films around today, Kill Bill, Sin City, it's about justice. These are films that reflect that the modern feels that we're living in a world without justice, and we long for justice. And if society, the system won't give us justice, we'll have to get it ourselves. But it's reflecting something very profound. Every human longs for justice. Powerful thing to play off in terms of our engagement with film. Seventh question, how does the story reflect relationships? Does it reflect deeply that we are relational creatures? We're created for relationships, intended for deep connections with others. And when this is perverted, it all goes out of shape. Eighth question, how does redemption fit into the story? Who needs saving? Who is the Messiah? So many films all about this. Someone who needs saving and someone who comes along as Messiah. And the ninth question, does the story have hope when it looks to the future? Is there a future that we can look forward to? Now I've skipped through those very quickly, just to say that every one of these questions are deeply embedded in the Christian worldview. Deeply embedded. And we need to learn to evaluate film from this perspective, from the worldview perspective, asking these questions. Not in too analytical way, but just have them in the back of your mind as you deal with films. All films are dealing with these issues, worldview issues. Fourthly, and very briefly, I promise, some checkpoints for our use of films. And I'm just going to whiz through a few subheadings. There are some checkpoints for our use of films. Firstly, enjoy them yourself. If you're going to connect in a real way with unbelievers on the subject of film, they need to see that you love them and you understand them. If it's just a tool to bat them over the head with, it's not a real engagement. The engagement with the unbeliever is, I love this film, do you love it? And then out of this comes a real discussion. It's not just an evangelistic tool. You need to love them yourself. And the more I watch film, the more I receive them. Not all of them, but I receive many films as a gift from God with thanksgiving. They're extraordinary. And I love sharing films with my family. When we eat together around the table, most of our meaningful discussions now are around film. I've got teenagers. I love watching films together and discussing them. So thankful for the gift of film. So enjoy them yourself. Secondly, I feel this one strongly. One of my kids doesn't so much. If a film is worth watching once, it's worth a dozen viewings. And I think the problem with film today is there's so much out there. If I ask you guys, what's your favorite five films, many of you would be tempted to give me the last five films you saw. We watch so many and then we forget them. They're so powerful and then we move on. But actually, film becomes so powerful in your life if you go back to it time and time again. We're talking about Magnolia. It's such a magnificent film, a hard film, but a magnificent film, especially in terms of its, as I say, its story and its worldview. It gets so much better as you keep watching it. It just grows and grows and grows. American Beauty, the same. It's huge. So if a film's worth watching once, it's worth a dozen viewings. Thirdly, you need to know your limits. And as much as possible, the limits of those you share a film with. I have watched films that I deeply regretted watching, but left scars, and as I hopefully am maturing in Christ, I know more my limits, what I can watch and what I can't watch. Now, occasionally, I'll watch a film that I really don't want to watch for the point of engagement, and I ask the Lord to cover me. But I have limits, and actually, I'm quite sensitive when it comes to film. And we need to appreciate that what deeply and negatively affects one doesn't touch another. So I don't cast judgment on people who watch a film that I'm horrified by. I think there are limits. But we're all different here. We need to know our limits. And at LaBrie, where I work, when I show a film to a public audience, I'm always very, very careful. If one person trips up, I feel dreadful. So I give a very appropriate health warning before we watch it, and I always give a get-out clause. Absolutely no shame in walking out of this room. You find this difficult to watch, get out. We made a big mistake showing Magnolia once without that health warning, and a girl who'd been badly abused as a child, it traumatized her. It took months to recover her from it. So it just shows we have to be so careful how we use films. On the practical side, on my fourth subheading, and I'm finishing here, very practical here, I'd encourage you as staff workers to teach the students within your CU how to watch films. Teach them how to do it. Most youngsters don't really know how to watch a film today. Teach them how to watch it with them and discuss it with them. And as you do that with them, they're going to be prepared to engage other students at this level in their conversations. It's so powerful for them as they move out and seek to be witnesses on campus. If they know how to watch films and watch them intelligently and remember that the advantage is in the narrative, in the story, it's so powerful. And I think it's part of what mentoring students is about, is teaching them how to watch films. And then I'm just throwing this out as a statement, second practical point here, is I'm sure many of you are doing it, but we need to think creatively about more formal film nights within the university context. I think they can be used very, very creatively. Brief introduction, showing the film, then a discussion. If I'm working as a subversive apologist, I'm quite happy to have a discussion that doesn't get to the gospel, the core gospel. It's just dealing with the issues that come out of the film, provoking, say, rattling the cage. But I think it's something on campus that can be used very effectively if it's done in the right way. I'm done. Let's open it up for discussion. Actually, just let me pray. Father, there is much within our modern context which distresses us. We think of Paul walking around Athens, and he was deeply distressed, convulsed by the brokenness of what he saw in that city. And we feel that too. And yet at the same time, we recognize the enormous benefits of living in our times. And we thank you for the huge benefit and joy of film, both for our own personal enjoyment and edification, and also as a very effective tool for reaching out to those who are lost outside the Christian faith. And we pray that you would teach us how to use this powerful medium effectively in our engagement with non-Christians, and especially with those who are completely closed, that using film in this sense would open doors as we rattle cages and seek to bring your love to people. So we just thank you for the many opportunities afforded us through film. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. What time did this finish? We've got 20-odd minutes for discussion, is that right? The second, the third, in terms of the ideas undergirding the story, they are either rehashing them or making them so convoluted I couldn't follow it anymore. Second one I found the hardest. In terms of where it's coming from, definitely not Christian. It's very eclectic. In that sense, it's a perfect postmodern film. It's a bit of everything. And I think at the end of the day, it had the last one especially felt very Eastern. To me, much more Eastern than it did. Christian's Eastern. Christianity's Eastern. But you know what I mean by Eastern. It felt much more Eastern. So I like you, I love the first. The second struggled a bit more. The third came up a little bit, although I felt it became a bit sentimental for me. The first two weren't sentimental. That's my greatest critique of a film is sentimentality. I think they're where films don't score for me, many of them, is they're so sentimental. They cater to really surface emotion. It's not helpful. Degrading, actually. But yeah, but incredible. I still think they're epic in terms of the story. You know, it's dealing with a story. Epic for me is a story as big as the universe. And good and evil, absolutely huge. And the problem with the Matrix series for me is it was almost too symbolically loaded. And that made following the story sometimes quite difficult. And I don't find it easy to do narrative. I'm a philosopher by background, and I just want to go for the worldview, propositional content. And there are so many symbols here, and the analyzation of them all was distracting for me at times. But I think if you just see it as a story, 1, 2, 3, it's brilliant. Fantastic.
There's loads of theories on the Matrix films. Actually, they're quite interesting, and I think it's fair to say that the other two films are just complete trash. Yeah. Actually, yeah. There's lots of going on there. It's just really complicated. Yeah. But actually, the authors have really thought about it quite deeply, and it's just difficult to follow it.
Yeah.
But working hard at it, actually, there's a reward there. Yes. I think.
My son, who has an extraordinary eye for film, he says the same. He almost leads me. I mean, I actually do believe that. I can't see it. Right. Yep. I think when the brothers, whatever their name are, I've forgotten.
Larry and Andrew Wachowski.
Wachowski, that's right. When they hear Christians or anyone else sort of nail it down as this is on our side, they must laugh and laugh and laugh.
It's the same old Christians.
That's right. Yeah.
Isn't that a major problem? Because I see one thing in the film, and I can even see the meta narrative and probably guess rightly where they're coming from. And my friends see something completely different. So it's impossible to have a conversation with them because they say, well, that's great for you, and this is for me, going back to base communism again. And it's hard to communicate anything with people who just see something completely differently.
Yeah. It can be the problem. I suppose if we're looking for firm conclusions out of a discussion, it can be difficult. But for me, subversion is just rattling cages. And I found the Matrix films extraordinary for the level of dialogue that could take place around them. I think there were many aspects of that story which do connect with our meta-narrative. The One. I mean, here's the chosen one to save the world. Well, wow. That's straight out of Hebrew. The Hebrew Bible, it's the same language. And actually, Matrix was incredibly sophisticated, say, philosophically. Those two guys were conversant with all the postmodern philosophers. Baudrillard is one of my, I don't quite understand him, my favorite contemporary philosopher. And his ideas are just all the way through the film. And actually, in the first one, when those guys knock on the door, want to get the bootleg programs from Neo, and he opens the book, it's Baudrillard's Simulacra and Simulation. That's the book he opens. So those guys, it is so thoughtful. And just the very thoughtfulness of it within the story creates a dialogue. But
so it's just conversation starters.
Yeah, in a sense, that's what it is. The idea of showing the Matrix and doing an altar call, for me, is utterly ludicrous. A little bit like a heavy metal Christian rock band, and it is great, they're enthusiastic, but you can't hear a single word they're singing. And then at the end, come forward, and you think, well, what are they responding to? The gospel isn't in Matrix. That's why I put it in that first stage. This is what you're doing with people who are completely closed. It's just getting a conversation going. And for people in the office or on campus, it's often that thoughtful conversation is something you can pick up later. Hey, you remember, boom, and it's just something to key off of rather than talking about the weather. It's all right to talk about weather.
A lot of people use films, especially DVDs, as an opportunity to disengage, to have that sentimental experience, to enter this whole other realm for a bit, and then not think about it again.
Yeah.
But what you're proposing is much more of an apologetic tool. How do you kind of deal with the two different things? You just accept that even we ourselves sometimes just don't want to have to think about a film once it's finished.
Yeah.
Or are you proposing that actually, no, we should be engaging each time and trying to encourage other people because they're picking something up?
Yeah. I don't think our engagement with film should ever be passive. Mine is sometimes, but I don't think it should be. But neither do I think, watching James Bond, we have to be, trying to work out the geopolitics of our times through it. Films are there to be enjoyed. But my worry is that most people watch films incredibly passively, which is why if you put it into a context, a formal context, people are just surprised. Wow, I didn't know that was there. Because many, many films are incredibly thoughtful. There's so much there, but people aren't getting it. We have to help them to get it. That's what I want to teach my children. Oh, they're teaching me now to watch films like that. So you're right, that is how many watch it, but I think our engagement with them can help them to see more. And that's incredibly important. I'll put it like this too. I think in doing that, we rescue them from idolatry. Because I could give a whole lecture on film, which makes me want to run away from it. In fact, I have given a lecture on it. I think my definition of an idol is a representation which is mistaken for real. So you bow down to the stone and you say, "You're my God." It's just a representation. And at the end of the day, only God is beyond representation, which we can't have a representation of God either. So mistaking representations for reality is an extremely serious thing. And actually, this is where I think we need to make a distinction between fantasy and imagination. Tolkien, the Lord of the Rings trilogy, is used by many just as fantasy. It's a fantasy world. It's not an imaginative world. And my definition of fantasy, really, all fantasy is pornography. And pornography is where you satisfy a real desire in an unreal world, and that unreal world is so close to the real that you can almost mistake the fantasy object for reality. And that's also part of the nature of idolatry in the Bible. So films, I think, are used by many in a very idolatrous fashion. But I don't think they have to be. In fact, I know they don't have to be. So it's redeeming film in that sense. Engaging someone with film just to help them escape idolatry, it's a good thing in and of itself. And we as Christians certainly should be very quick there.
I was just going to say, I think it's great to sum up to us going to the pub or going to a nightclub where actually I want to go to the pub to enjoy myself, but I wouldn't ever consider going there without being fully switched on and thinking through the situations that I'm going to find myself in. So
absolutely.
I just agree with what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, don't leave your brain at the box office when you buy a ticket to go see a film.
Just kind of following on from what you're saying, obviously Star Wars is classic for kind of cult following, and just thinking about idolatry and fantasy and what have you, but what's your thoughts on it becoming such a cult following and how people put the name, like Jedi, as their own religion on a sort of census form? Like, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, belonging to that cult myself, I have to be.
yeah,
that's right. Yeah. I mean, it's just the lengths to which we take it, isn't it?
Do you think these people are engaging, or are they actually escaping? Is it escapism in that sense?
I'm sure it can be. I'm not so sure. It is as much as we think it is. When the people who take these kind of films very seriously, let me give you another cult film, Donnie Darko. I mean, it's incredible. I don't understand it fully. But it's a very powerful film. And when you watch it, that it's raising some incredibly important issues. It's also playing with your brain. But there's something in that which is so powerful. And it's a cult film. Now, the people I meet at Le Brie who belong to this cult, and one of my sons does too, I don't sense they're switching off. They're really serious about the ideas in the film, and they actually really believe there's something there which is worthwhile. And I know Christians who would say the same about that film, that actually, the first time I watched it, I felt it was perhaps sinister and dark, but I'm beginning to think actually it's quite different. It really is about a Messiah, someone who is a savior. So I guess it depends how we join the cult. We can join a cult where it becomes worship, and that's just pure idolatry, I guess, but it doesn't have to be.
I just think it's worth observing that for the non-Christian watching the film, they will often act on the basis of what they read. I think would we have a Scottish Parliament without Braveheart?
Yeah.
We came at just the right moment for the politicians.
Yeah. I mean, that's the influence and power of it. It's huge. I agree. And I'm not, for all my love of film, I'm not someone who, you know, when I hear people say that, oh, it doesn't affect children's behavior and all the rest of it, I think these people are in cuckoo land. Of course it affects behavior. I see it. My own were young. They'd watch a warrior film and go outside and pick up sticks and be warriors. I mean, so it does have an impact. This isn't film and art, but just yesterday, those two Thai fishermen who raped and killed the British woman, and they'd been watching pornography. That's what they said, looking at pornography and drunk. This is what it led to. I haven't touched the dangers. I only touched the advantages. There are massive dangers.
Just a question. It's about a film that I've been
well, it really has a powerful impact on me, and I was just thinking about the benefits or not, or how to engage with someone who's not Christian. I think it was a very, very powerful film and totally took you into the story, so the story element that you were talking about was very strong, and it's Million Dollar Baby. Mm. And clearly there were lots of those questions that you gave, there were lots of things there, so relationships, redemption, all of those things. But because it was such a powerful story, I won't give the end away, but the driving where that story was taken to, I found it almost that it was really rattling my cage, and the first time I saw it, I was actually quite relieved that some friends were invited to come with us didn't come. Now, in that sort of situation, is it just a judgment call about whether something's actually, do you know what I mean, more subversive or not helpful?
Yeah.
Sorry, that was a bit rambling, but does that
make sense? No, it's very helpful.
Clint Eastwood, Mel Gibson. There's a total contrast. The one, for all his faults, lives within a supernaturalist universe, which is governed by God, very strong Catholic faith. Clint Eastwood, it's a naturalist universe. It's empty of meaning and so forth. Tells a dang good story, though, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. Clint Eastwood, and writes some good music with it. I was at a conference last year with Charles Colson, who's done a lot on the kind of moral issues, abortion and euthanasia, and he utterly detested that film. I don't think that is what the whole film is about, though. And I'm sympathetic to Chuck Colson, this is his issue, but that for me was the overactive moral consciousness. And he didn't engage with the story. And I think there are some very redeeming aspects in that film. And I don't think it's a film about euthanasia. That's not the key. That's not even the most important part of the story.
No, and I suppose that's where my turmoil about it comes from, because it's so strong about this relationship, about the dignity that
Absolutely.
The coach gives to the young girl.
Yeah.
So I suppose it's because of that.
Absolutely. And that, I think that's the most powerful aspect of that film. And for at Le Brie, we watched it once. For some of the young women who were staying with us, it was huge, for that very reason, actually.
Yeah. That's a good question. I'm just interested to see what you'd say to this, because I find it really difficult to both engage with the film and the ideas that the film is selling, and also turn it around to a gospel opportunity. I'd be interested to hear your take on collateral, and you've got the whole nihilistic, life is meaningless, Tom Cruise character and the other guy with hope, but that, ultimately his hope isn't real hope, really, is it?
No.
And there's massive doors to be open there for the gospel, isn't there? But
yeah.
If I can say a talk,
yeah.
Do you just really stop engaging with the film and then bring in your, well, this is what the Bible says, it's not nihilistic, life has purpose, and, and then in the gospel there's real hope. That seems like a bolt-on, and you've stopped engaging with the film at that point.
Yeah.
So how do you handle that?
Yep. This again is where I'd go back to the apologetic spectrum. And please take everything I've said as first stage here. I love talking about Christ. There's nothing I enjoy more than sharing Christ with someone. And just saying, this is what he's done for you. And this is the offer to you. But we live in a context now, as you all know all too well, more than I do, university campuses, where it's very hard to do that. Well, you can do it, but there's just such a resistance. And I'm interested in how we reach the closed. A lot of my work at Le Brie is actually dealing with people who are already open. They're coming open. But increasingly over the last 5 years, I'm going out of Le Brie into my village and so forth, because I realize I'm in an unnatural situation. So when I talk about film as an apologetic tool, it is subversive apologetics. And I have no guilt whatsoever watching a film with someone, having a discussion, and not mentioning the word Christ or God even once. Because it's just rattling their cage. It's getting them to think. I'm inside their worldview. Inside a story, inside another person's worldview, and I'm pushing it. What do you think? So in Collateral, the crew's character is just so sad, isn't he? Max is pretty sad too, but you know he's going to do something with his life, and he's dignified. There's a dignity to him, and I mean, with most people today, let's be honest, you can immediately, if it's someone you don't know very well, go into profound conversation, but just something you shared. And if you're in the same office with them or the same classroom or dormitory, whatever, it's just something you can pick up along the way. And I find with one of my very close friends who's anything but a believer, it's just always where we go, films. And he's growing to love films and watch them in a new way. And it depends the context. In certain contexts, it might be very appropriate just to go right for it. Here's the Christian faith. But with the type of people I'm interested in reaching, it's the long haul. It's being quite content to have an evening together, sharing in something, just redeeming them from idolatry. So they see there's something important there, and a few engagements at the end.
So you would use... Say, you
just
have to pick out maybe sort of holes in their worldviews and to try and make them uncomfortable with their current beliefs.
I'd probably go with a question. Do you ever feel like Max? You know, you go to the office 9 to 5 every day and it's always the same, and you have all these dreams of what you're going to do, your postcard, and we never achieve it. You know, to bring. So, Paul, what are we doing with our lives? There's a question. Throw it out there.
The point you made about knowing your limit, I think that's something that every time I watch a film, I'm thinking, is this all right to watch? And you know, when films come out, I'm just aware of that. Is there any way that, because I imagine it would be about being honest with yourself, and that's, I don't know if that's necessarily a good gauge of... You know, tell what your limits are, but try to be honest with yourself, because I would tend to justify watching it for some other reason.
Yeah.
So how would you know what your limits are? Like, would you come out and feel guilty, for instance, or you know, because you'd say that, I wonder if you had any sort of insights into that.
Well, my background in terms of childhood is we didn't have a television. We didn't watch movies except for Chariots of Fire at least once a month. You know, I've just realized it's a great film. I was so turned off it because it's all I could watch. And I watched it a few years ago and thought, this is fantastic. What a great piece of cinematography. But I come from a very sheltered background when it comes to all of that. And my journey into film has been quite slow and gradual. Sometimes my wife and I do a reality check and say, hang on, we wouldn't have watched that a year ago. Are we all right? Now, we both come from the overactive moral consciousness and a performance-orientated Christianity, which many come from today, following Christ is about what you do. And it includes that, but it's not ultimately what it is. So we come from that background. And in some ways, we've had to be educated. And this is the thing about the conscience. The conscience is one of the most valuable gifts of God to us, but it too has been distorted. Then it needs to be educated. Now, we need to be very sensitive. Romans 14 and 15, whole, you know, the weaker brother thing. You don't just bat someone over the head in order to liberate them. And I see this happen all the time with youngsters. Strict background, liberated, and just utter chaos. I don't think our struggle today is legalism, it's antinomianism. People just feel they have so few boundaries on their lives, but that's my story. We came to it gradually. I mean, the signs for me was, you know, trying to get off to sleep that night or the next night, and some of the images plaguing my mind and taking me places where I should ought not to be. I, you know, not mature enough to deal with that.
Skim through it at fast speed in 10 minutes, gives you some idea whether it's really right. I do that with my teenage boys.
Right. Yeah.
They come home, I'm going to have a look at this first before I let you watch it. Because if you sat for 2 hours and then you find you're goofed.
Yeah.
As you say, if you've had a quick skim, it's worth watching through the second time at proper full speed.
I certainly never, I had the most embarrassing situation where I watched a film with a group of others that I'd never watched before, and the recommendation of someone has said, no, this is sound all the way through, and it was the, oh, I don't believe it. What are we watching? But
you may have been already comfortable watching it yourself.
Yeah, possibly. There are some films, I mean, I'm a married man. There are some films where it's actually helpful. Like, it took me a long time to watch Magnolia. Because I am quite sensitive there, and Helen and I said we'd do it together. And watching it with her, it just made it so much easier. Other films are bloke films or girl films, and I wouldn't want to watch it with Helen. I want to watch it with my bloke friends, Master and Commander,